I am Paula Andrews, and for some of you, you might think my claim to fame is to be is being Steve Andrews' wife, but it's not. I'm actually Lindy Underdown's mother. And I can't believe I forgot to put a picture of my granddaughter in this PowerPoint. That was the first thing I was going to do. Because remember when Dee Dee, for some of you who have been around, my sister Dee Dee, oh, I gave it away. That's my real claim to fame. I'm Dee Dee's sister. Younger sister. But Dee Dee would sneak in pictures of her grandchildren. She'd be in the middle of some really serious point, and also one of her grandchildren would pop up. Okay, next semester, I'm doing it. I'm going to have pictures. So, but anyway, I am the grandmother of Marguerite Underdown, and she's amazing. And she was here a little bit ago, I understand, so I missed her. And so did you guys, apparently. But I will have pictures next time. I am also, if you came week one, Dee Dee talked about Apollo, who wanted to do Hosea. Are you guys hating on me now? Just to comfort you, you just made it through the worst chapters in the entire book. Okay? You're done. You're really out of the woods. And Phyllis Bond is coming next week, and she told me to let you guys know she's bringing the love. Okay? She's going to bring the love luck next week. But this week, we do have to deal with some very hard chapters in the Bible. And I want to kind of go back through the beginning, just to review a few things, because I want to explain to you why Hosea means so much to me and why I bugged Dee Dee to do it. Obviously, I want us to be able to handle all of God's Word. And prophets really are. The prophets are hard to handle. And so if we can get a little bit of some skill here and some confidence as we look at this book, hopefully you'll have the courage to look at others and read some of the other amazing prophets that are in the Bible. So hang in there. Keep going. You really made it through the worst. Next week actually is our last week in Hosea. So, and the love's coming. But tonight, we have to look at some hard chapters. There is only one tiny little verse in these three chapters where there's a smidgen of the love. Every other verse is just horrifying. And it's hard. Some of the most beautiful words God speaks of love are in some of these other chapters. And if we only took them out of the book of Hosea, we would be undone by their beauty. They're such amazing words. The problem is we don't always see them because they're hidden and strewn through chapters that are just gut-wrenching and harsh. And it feels like, as we read them, that we've follow an angry God. And I've even heard people come to me and they say, you know, Paul, it feels like there's two gods when I read the Bible. There's this God in the Old Testament who's just mean and angry. He's like happy to smash you, God. You know, he just wants to get you. He's a vigilante, you know, running around smashing everybody. And then there's this wonderful God in the New Testament. There's Jesus. And we, you know, he's just wonderful and he's loving. And actually, I thought that too. When I was growing up, obviously I grew up in the same home as Dee Dee, in this amazing Christian loving home. But as I looked at the Bible, I really struggled with that. And in fact, when I read the words of this angry God, I thought, yeah, this feels right. This is probably how it really is. I read the New Testament, I thought, this is too good to be true. This can't be true. Jesus is too good. I don't think it's real. And actually, if God is this God of the Old Testament, why even bother? Why follow a God that's so angry and so horrifying? So I stopped. I did exactly what Gomer did. I ran from a beautiful home, a God I didn't understand while I was still in, from high school to college. I chased the thrills and the excitement that the world offered. I decided that the faith that my family had was very archaic. It wasn't sophisticated. It didn't follow the culture that I was in. It was irrelevant. It was ancient beliefs, had no connection to the world as it was. I loved the parties. I loved the academics. They made me feel so, you know, heady. Wow, look at me. I'm so smart. I'm so sophisticated here. I'm my own God. I determined my fate. But God loved me with a love that would not let me go, and he came after me. And he used this story of Hosea, huge in my life, That's why I begged you guys to study it, and I hope somehow through my story, through some of the things you've been seeing and hearing in God, you will fall in love with this amazing book, because it helped me see what was going on with these angry words. And the first thing we find out when we open this book is that God is being dethroned in a marriage. Dede went through these chapters, the first couple chapters, but she wasn't here. This was when she had her gallbladder out. But Elspeth Put did an amazing job of inserting the PowerPoint and everything in the lecture. So if you pop to Insight's website, and if you click on the little date, I think it's the second week of Hosea, Dede's whole lecture pops up, and you can read it, and it's fabulous, and it explains so beautifully this marriage and what was going on. But just for the sake of looking at why God feels so angry in these chapters, I just want to review a little bit and go back over this. But because God had sent prophets to speak to the people, to tell them how they were destroying themselves. In Hosea, though, he did something really different. He took a marriage. He asked the prophet by his life to live out the nightmare that God was living with his people Israel. He was asking Hosea to feel what he himself felt and then express through this book what God was feeling when he's being dethroned from the marriage, when we walk away from him. These are the anguished sobs of a lover. They are angry words. They're not the words I thought they were. They're not said with glee or spite. They are pain-filled. And when I like to think about this marriage, and when I first confronted this book, when I started thinking about it, maybe Gomer, when God told Hosea to marry her, maybe she was a little girl that had grown up down the street from him. Maybe he watched her as she slowly left the Jewish faith, or slowly left the culture and went out into this world of the Baals and all the excitement of the parties and of what the nation of Israel was starting to experience. And maybe his heart broke as he watched this young girl. Or maybe as he was out preaching one day, his eyes fell on her, this beautiful young woman who was using her beauty to get lovers, but was about to end up in a life of pain. I don't know. We have no idea. All we do know, though, is Hosea was probably about 20 years old when he was called. Because of the length of his ministry through the different kings, most people think he was probably 20. My son just turned 20 this month. If God asked him to marry a prostitute, my heart would break. Talk about anger. I would be so ranting and raving at God. What are you thinking? Why are you asking him to do this? And I'm sure Hosea's mother probably felt this way, and Hosea's aunts and grandmothers and friends and everything. You're like, what is up with you, Hosea? Why are you marrying this girl? And then I kind of love to think about, why did Gomer want to marry him? Did she think, possibly she was sick of this lifestyle. Maybe she thought, you know what? I am so tired of being used. I'm so tired of no one loving me. I think I'll marry this guy. Maybe she thought it'd be a kick to marry a preacher. I could tell her something about that. Maybe she hoped he would save her. You see, that's what happened to me. I was Gomer. And when I finally turned back to the life I was living, it was because God became to me like Hosea was to Gomer. And one of the things God did, I can read it to you. It's God is speaking in Hosea 2, 6 through 7. He goes, I will block her path with thorn bushes. I will wall her in so that she cannot find her way. She will chase after her lovers but not catch them. God allowed my world of self-sufficiency to be crushed in a really, really strange way. I was up at Michigan State living in a home with three other girls. We thought we were all, you know, we just were living the big life. It was late 60s, early 70s, so peace, love, and all that was going on. And a man broke into our house. And in the middle of the night, I heard screaming. I was fast asleep. I jumped out of my bed. I ran out into this our little sitting area, and there was my roommate, and her lips were bleeding, her arms had been, they were all scraped up and everything because she had been struggling. And she was standing there with this young man, and I didn't know who he was, but all I know is she was sitting there saying to him, "Go, please go, just go, just go," and she's sobbing. And I'm standing there, I'm so confused, so disoriented, I'd been fast asleep, and she sees me standing there, and so she runs behind me. And suddenly, I'm standing there in front of a man who's broken into our house with my roommate behind me. I wish I could change this story and lie to you guys. Because what I'd really like to say at this point is I did some really awesome, kick butt moves, and took him down, and we handcuffed him, and, no. I love those movies. I know Lindy and my daughters think I'm insane, but I love those movies with a heroine. She can disarm a guy and takes all his guns off and his chains and knives, and, she's just this amazing. I didn't have any of that. None of that. And, in fact, when my roommate later explained to the police what happened, I didn't even remember this happening. So I have to go by her word. But back in that day, in the early 70s, we didn't have the thin lenses they have now on glasses. Instead, we had really, truly, I had Coke bottle glasses. I wore contacts, but at night I had these big, thick glasses, and the style was round, so you can imagine these big, round things, and they made my eyes look like these two little bitty marbles. And my roommate said, what happened is, as a guy standing there in front of me, all of a sudden my eyes started going, and I was like, and she actually was scared. Oh, no, Paula's losing it. But I was kind of doing this, and then I went, no, no, no. And it was just, and so he did kind of step back. I guess I scared him. And he just stood there. And so suddenly I did have kind of a really cool kick button idea. I yelled to our other two roommates who did not come out. They actually stayed in their room because they were so terrified. And I yelled to them, call the police. Here's where I'm cool. We didn't have cell phones back then. And I knew my roommates, there was no phone in that bedroom. But they yelled back, we're calling the police! So he obviously realized, he didn't realize there were two other people in the house. He didn't, and he was very disoriented and he bolted. And it was so funny because later when I told my mother, and I mean, my mother was this big. I mean, she was just this tiny little Marguerite, this tiny little thing. And as I was telling her the story, she said, you girls could have taken him. That's easy for you to say, Mom. But you know what the amazing thing was? I couldn't take him. I was terrified. I was victimized. I felt powerless in front of him. God had hedged me in. Oh, there's PowerPoint's gone. He had totally put up a wall. And I didn't know where to go. I laid in my bed that night, and I sat there thinking, there is no safe place in this world. There's no safe place. I thought the world was a pretty cool place that I could be, just in control of. And suddenly I felt so powerless, so vulnerable. And I realized there were men out there who wanted to hurt women for their own pleasure. And it was a terrifying, eye-opening moment. And not long after that incident, God used other things to wall me in, to throw up thorns, and I decided to go back to God because I needed a safe place. But like Gomer, I wasn't sure I could stay. I didn't know if I could stick it out. And I remember praying to God and saying, and I wrote it in my journal, and I said, God, I don't know if I can hang here with you. This is hard. It feels hard to follow you. No one else in this world is really following you. I feel so awkward and odd and out of step with everything going around. But you see, it feels like you're the only safe place. Can you help me? And I actually said, God, I will stay with you even if it never feels right. Because I think you're it. I think you're all I have. Well, I didn't bolt, and I didn't let Gomer, and I didn't give up, because God, in Hosea 2:14, he says to Gomer, I and to Israel, I am now going to allure her. I love that word. I love that. I will lead her into the wilderness and speak tenderly to her. And I feel like God removed me. He removed me from all my friends, all the things that were going on around me, and took me into a very, very quiet place and began to speak tenderly to me. And I began to hear a voice that was so different than all the years I'd been reading the Bible, not understanding his voice. And the way this came about, I was invited, right, not too long after, to go to a conference. And it was filled with thousands of Christians. I'd never done anything like that before. I'm sitting there going, oh my goodness, I didn't know there were that many Christians in this world, let alone all in one place like this. And it was so incredible, and I was sitting there, and this man got up on the stage, and he opened up the book, the Bible, to the book of Hosea. And I don't think I'd ever heard it before or read it. And he began to speak tenderly through this story, explaining to me how I was loved with a love that would never let me go, even though I wasn't sure that I could stay. And it's incredible because I was just sobbing through this, and I felt like I was the only person in the room that was being talked to that day. And it was an unbelievable moment that God was going to begin to teach me and speak to me tenderly about how precious I was to him. What happens next in this marriage, Phyllis talked about 2 weeks ago, and there's just one thing I want to highlight from it. If you want to open to your Bibles, it's in verse 1 of chapter 3. Because Hosea's asked one more time to go after this woman. One more time, he's told. He's just like God. He is sharing in this humiliation and betrayal. He's not even sure at time, you know, he may not, these children, he's not even sure they're his. And God asks him to love her. In chapter 3, go once more. This woman's bolted from your home. She's on a slave block. And Hosea goes through the back alleys until he finds her. And it, how, and what does it say in verse 2? So he says, so I bought her. God says, go love. And Hosea buys. That was what the love cost. It wasn't good enough. God didn't say, go and help the women of the street. You know, hand out some blankets, maybe a little, you know, a cup of coffee or something. Just go be a good guy, Gomer, you know, Hosea. Go out and show these women what. No, God said, no, love her. Go love her. And the cost of the love was to buy her back as a slave. And the words that follow here, and this is what Phyllis 2 weeks ago did such a beautiful job explaining to us, but I want to look one more time at these words where God, where Hosea says to Gomer, you are to live with me many days, you must not be a prostitute or be intimate with any man, and I will behave the same way to you. Those are not words of anger. Hosea is not speaking in anger to Gomer. And one of the ways I believe this, because I have been introduced to some of the counseling and rehabilitation that's taking place for women and children who are coming out of sex trafficking. And I went to their website, several of the different ones, and listened to these words. The websites for sex trafficking rehab, this is what they say. We provide safe housing. Long-term care, we give them time to heal. Direct quotes. What Hosea is offering, keep tricking me, Elspeth. What Hosea is offering to Gomer is a safe place. He says, come away, dwell with me, I will keep you safe. I will even set aside my sexual desires. I'll put them aside because I only want to serve you, and I want you to heal. I want you to come into my home, and I want you to heal, and I will give you time. No one's going to use you. It was pure, selfless, one-sided love. because there's no indication whether Gomer ever returned his love. The anger is not when he buys her. The anger is not when he marries her. But we hear anger when she wants her own way. When she runs away, the words are filled with anger. We see God's anger within this book because she has run away, because Israel will not come back to him. There's more, and I'd like to take you back, because Dee Dee always says you have to go back to the garden to kind of get this picture, because you asked why. Why, God, does it matter so much to you if we run or not? Why don't you just say, toodaloo, got plenty of people, you can go your own way, I'm just going to love these people. Why do you get so angry when we run? And so let's go back to the garden, and I'm not going to answer this for you, but these are just some things kind of stirring up in my head as I was thinking and studying to see. When we go back to the garden, we find God is dethroned in the garden. Again, we went our own way in the garden, and we threw God off the throne. And here his anger looks like protection. He was protecting us, trying to keep us, because he had created this beautiful, safe, perfect place. Even the animals, they wouldn't hurt us. They wouldn't eat us or bite us. You know, we could hang with the animals, kind of like, which Disney princess, you know, dances around with all the animals? Was that Snow White? Yeah. I mean, we're all Snow White. You know, here we are. We're dancing and singing with the princess, or with the animals, and we're safe. It was a perfect, safe environment where we could dwell with God. And in fact, in the cool of the evening, the book of Genesis says God would come and walk with Adam and Eve. But Satan poses this question. Did God really say? Did God really say all this? Imagine with me, crazy thought, what if Adam and Eve had said, wow, good question, Satan. You know what? Little bit, cool of the evening, God's walking by, let's ask him. What would have happened? How would the world have been different if they had simply taken that to God? But they didn't. They went their own way, and they were thrown out, and God was thrown, dethroned. So instead of a garden, God decides, okay, I'll set up a nation. And he calls Abraham, and he says, Abraham, I'm going to make you this nation. I'm going to establish rulers and kings and priests, and we're going to set up boundaries, and we're going to understand, here's my expectations. And you do this, and this happens, or don't do this, and this happens. It's all going to be clear, and I'm going to create a place in the middle. Just like I was with you in the garden, I'll create a place here where I will dwell. You can come to me and worship me, and we'll be together, and this is what we're going to do. I'm going to make a covenant with you, a binding, permanent agreement. I will be your God, you will be my people, I will place a king on the throne, and he is going to provide justice and peace for all the people in the kingdom. Did God do this because he was picking favorites? Like, I love Israel more than anyone, because that's who he named these people when he went to Abraham. Well, the Bible doesn't give us that. I mean, the Bible's clear. That was not God's intention. Instead, he says in Isaiah, he goes, I want you to be a light. And for who? The Gentiles. Not just other Jews. I want you to be a light for the world. I am picking you as a nation because I want to save the world. And I want all peoples, not just the Jewish people, I want all peoples to be blessed. So his plan to save the world was coming through this nation of Israel to be a light and a blessing. Dee Dee had us look at Deuteronomy 28. This is the clearest, most succinct picture of what this covenant was, this agreement God was making with Israel. Here we go. And he says, I'm going to start because you can't see the top. He says, if you fully obey the Lord and carefully follow all his commands, he will set you high above all the nations on the earth. They were going to be what he calls the head and not the tail. They were going to be the leaders, not the followers. And then he has this poetic language where he says, you're going to be blessed in the city, blessed in the country. The fruit of your womb will be blessed. And the crops and the young of your livestock, the calves of your herds, the lambs of your flocks. And I love this, your basket and your kneading trough will be blessed. You will not go hungry. In fact, the Lord is going to grant that the enemies who rise up against you will be defeated before you. They'll come at you from one direction, but flee from you in seven. And all the peoples on the earth will see that you are called by the name of the Lord, and they will fear you. The Lord will open the heavens, the storehouse of his bounty, to send rain on your land and to bless all the works of your hands. You will lend to many nations, but will borrow from none. The Lord will make you the head, not the tail. What would happen if Israel had lived this out, had been a blessing of this caliber in the world? What would the rest of the world have reacted? Well, I did some fun stuff looking at what was going on in the rest of the world. I actually didn't do the whole rest of the world, because that's a lot of world history I would have had to cover. I just looked at Assyria, because they're the country that Israel was going to. If you look at some of the verses that we studied this week, Israel kept going to Assyria. Well, here's why. Assyria was this unbelievable empire. The British Museum has all this stuff. If you go to the British Museum's website, if you're a nerd like me, you will love this website. It is unbelievable, all the things they have in there, their displays, and it's just unbelievable. There was no power on earth until the Roman Empire, hundreds of years later, that ever had this domination that Assyria had in this area. They actually invented a language. They wrote reams of stuff. That's why we know so much about them, and that's why the British Museum is just filled with all the stuff they wrote, detailed stories of their wars and their conquerings and all the things they did. And they followed a god named Ashur, A-S-H-U-R. And one of their kings said this. He said, Ashur, father of the gods, empowered me to depopulate and repopulate to make broad the boundary of the land of Assyria. They believed their God was telling them to dominate the world, to overcome it. And they took siege works, if you study ancient wars, but they would, every city lived, and then you guys do that a lot. I love it. You're my girls. The cities had these huge walls around them to keep them safe, and so the Assyrians developed this extremely technical, detailed engineering feat to tear down these walls. They had this whole mining kind of thing going. They had siege works, these huge scaffoldings they would build. They actually, there's pictures of them when they would cross the rivers to get to the places, all these countries. I mean, they went down to Egypt, up to Turkey, over to Iran. I mean, they were conquering everything, Iraq. They actually would blow up animal skins. There's pictures of them blowing up animal skins and then swimming across the rivers. They would take apart all their equipment and put them on these blow up, like rafts, and ferry everything across to get all over, thousands and thousands and thousands of soldiers. They had a cavalry. I always say that wrong. They had a cavalry unrivaled. They would come at you with thousands and thousands of horses. And in fact, they would take, overrun these people groups, and one of the people groups tried to rebel. And the king writes in here that when he went to the city with these thousands and thousands of soldiers and siege works and horses lined up there, the people came out and they grabbed his feet and they just said, oh, if you decide to slay us, or if you'll let us live, let us live. And it says here, in really just cold language, he goes, so I flayed, impaled, beheaded, burnt alive, eyes put out, nose, fingers, ears cut off. Boom. Done. No rebellion. If you rebel, you're wiped out. But then I found the other night a really disturbing piece of evidence. Just recently, the Journal of Near Eastern Studies, a couple years ago, found some cuneiform tablets, that's the writing of the people of Assyria, from a building near Turkey in the governor's palace. And it was dated right about this time, about 745 BC, right about the time of Hosea. And on this piece of cuneiform writing was a list of 144 women. The Assyrians didn't always detail out the people groups they were overrunning and overpowering and coming against. For some reason, this piece survived with all the names of every one of these women. On this list, it was recorded that three of the women died. Because one of the things Assyria would do, they decided the really way to dominate the world is we're going to move the people from Egypt, we're going to take them up to Iran. So they would move 65,000 people, was one of the records, that they would move to Iran to totally humiliate and to they had no national sentiment anymore because they'd been ripped out of their homes, put over here, asked to work in these granaries or weavers or, you know, just be their slaves all over their empire. But in this piece, 144 women, and their names were listed. Impani and her son, Ursakina, Atu. And the archaeologists that found this said, we often don't find the names. And all the scientists and historians that are looking at this piece of writing felt it was very sobering because they read the names of 144 women, some of them with their sons, who were torn out of their homes and taken miles and miles and miles up to Turkey to work in a granary. Women, and the question I had is, I'm sure some of these women had daughters. Where were the daughters? What happened to them? Did they not survive when the Assyrian army rode into their village and impaled and flayed and raped and destroyed them? And these women marched thousands of miles up to Turkey, and their names are recorded. You know what? God knows every one of those women, and he watched their trek. And he asked that little circle, he said, would you be a light and a blessing? Because women and children are being destroyed in this world, and I need a different kind of nation. You don't need to go to Assyria. I will bless you. I will bless your kneading trough. I will bless your bread bowl, your baskets, your crops, your wombs. I will bless those. You be a blessing. Don't take from Assyria. Give to them. Feed the world. How would it have been different for those 144 women whose names were just discovered if Israel had obeyed the Lord? But they didn't obey. And when we look at Deuteronomy 28, we also see the curses. And these curses fall right in line with chapters 8 through 10 that you've been looking at this week. Israel rejected what is good, so an enemy pursues them. In Deuteronomy 28, it says, an enemy will come at you, and you will flee this time in seven directions if you fail to follow my commands. In 8:7, it says, we read that the stalk has no head, it will produce no flower. Were it to yield grain, foreigners would swallow it up. In other words, Israel was growing all this food, but these raiding Assyrians and others would just come in and grab all their food. They were being held like extortionists. They were like extorting goods and grains and food from Israel. And Israel was willingly giving it to them rather than trusting God to defeat their enemies. They were just, in a sense, what Hosea says, you're just prostituting yourself to these other nations. And that's what he was saying. In chapter 9, verses 12 through 14, there's some hard words. It's that God is saying, even if they rear children, I will bereave them of every one. Woe to them when I turn away from them. Ephraim will bring out their children to the slayer. And that's what happened. When Assyria came up against them with their siege works, and you look in the pictures, you'll see bodies being tossed off the wall. As the Assyrians would climb the wall, they would take whoever they were conquering and just throw them off. And it would be women and children dashed on the rocks. And that's how they defeated these countries. And in fact, if that map, Israel was just one little blip on their screen. When Israel went into captivity, it was a bunch of other people groups all around them were taken at the same time. They were of no account to Assyria. Assyria couldn't care less. They were just one more little ant to squish. And it's interesting because Hosea asks, what give the Lord? What will you give them? And God says, I will give them wombs that miscarry and breasts that are dry. Because to have a child come to term is going to be so horrifying in this day. It would be better to not even have children. It would be better to be barren, to be infertile. In 10:6, we see Ephraim will be disgraced. That's another word for Israel. Israel will be shamed of its foreign alliances. Thorns and thistles will grow up and cover their altars in chapter 10, verse 8. And then they will say to the mountains, cover us, and to the hills, fall on us. Israel went to the Baals instead of God. Israel went to Assyria and Egypt instead of their rightful position as the blessing and the light to all the world. And then they asked mountains to destroy them rather than calling out to God to save them. They were so far. When we hear God's anger here, when I hear it, I hear his anger over injustice. He waited from this moment when he told Moses, these are the curses. If you don't follow me, this is what's going to happen. What we read in chapters 8 through 10, it's 700 years before it comes. He is slow to anger. He is slow. How long, though, is long enough for God to watch the world tearing itself to shreds and no one is going to stand up and be a light and a blessing? How long? What is more evil here? That God waits and endures, or that he says to Israel, done. Done. I'm done. And so God was dethroned in Israel. Israel went their own way, and God was dethroned. And in fact, he says in 10:15, when that day dawned, the king of Israel will be completely destroyed, the last verse of this section. When the day dawns, which means the beginning of the battle, the battles begin at dawn, at the very start, Israel's king is going to be destroyed. No hope. His anger looks like that of a righteous judge. He's done. But is he done? That's what I love about God. Nowhere in the curses of Deuteronomy 28, I want to go back to this, I'm going to switch back, but look at that very last verse. Nowhere in the verses of this curse, of the cursing in Deuteronomy 28, is there any glimmer of hope. Just like I said in chapters 8 through 10, there's just one little glimmer of hope in all these verses you've been looking at. All these lists of all the things Israel's done wrong, this list, basically. Look at this last chapter, this last verse. It says, you will offer yourselves for sale to your enemies, male and female slaves, but no one will buy you. What did we just see in this book? Did we see a slave bought? In the middle of all these chapters of anger, like I said, God's weaving in Hosea some of the most beautiful words of tenderness that we have ever seen. So God is fulfilling the terms of his covenant. I'm done with you, Israel. Your king's going to be destroyed. We're done. But I'm not done. And he inserts in this book a marriage that is an unbelievable picture of grace. Because if you knew Levitical law, listen to this, Gomer should have never been married. I mean, Gomer, after she committed adultery, was to be stoned. That was the penalty for adultery. She should have been killed, but she wasn't killed. She should not have had children. The curse was that it was barrenness and fertility. In this book, she has three children. And she should have never been bought. Your enemies are not going to buy you. But your husband, your lover, will buy you back. even as God is fulfilling the terms of his covenant, in his anger, righteous anger, he's inserting a thread of grace and love that is baffling, and we don't understand because he undoes us. And my last is God is dethroned at the cross. The King of the Jews is dethroned at the cross. His anger here looks unimaginable, incomprehensible to us because now it's turned on his son. God's endings never seem to be the final story. A new king, the king of Israel, was destroyed, and 100 years later, the king of Judah is destroyed. But a new king's born in a stable, and guess who comes to find him? The Magi, who are descendants of the Babylonians and the Assyrians. The very nations that destroyed these kings are now the ones coming and asking Herod in Matthew chapter 2, verses 1 and 2, where is the one who is born king of the Jews? We've seen a star in the east and have come to worship him. God's story is so rich with all these threads. We have to keep reading. We can't give up. He is anger at pain, at injustice, at abuse, cheating, betrayals. All of that is placed on his son. And a whole new covenant is started. And in fact, we don't need to fear those curses that I read to you in Deuteronomy 28 or the curses you've read in chapters 8 through 10 of Hosea. Those are no longer God's words to us. They were placed on Jesus when he went to the cross as the king. In Galatians 3:13, it says, Christ redeemed us from the curse of the law by becoming a curse for us. For it is written, cursed is everyone who is hung on a tree. And here's a really fun little stay tuned announcement. In January, we're going to be studying Galatians. We're going to look at what is this new covenant? Because you know what, Paula? I'm not sure I believe you. I think I hear angry voices in my head. I hear God's anger. Those curses, I feel like they're on me. We'll come back in January. Let's pick up the book of Galatians and let's find out what this new covenant truly is and what it means. Because the old covenant with Israel is replaced by this new covenant. God made a way finally to save the world. He saved it himself with his own son. And he longs to be our king, our faithful husband, our loving father, and he calls us his bride. I will betroth you to me forever. I will betroth you in righteousness and justice, in love and compassion. I will betroth you in faithfulness, and you will acknowledge the Lord. I don't know when it happened, but one day I woke up and realized all those longings were gone. My Gomer longings to go back out and get wild. I thought, this is so stupid. Why would I want to do that? Why would I want to go eat in the garbage when Jesus has invited me to a banquet, a marriage feast? Why would I want to? Following God might be new to some of you, and you may be in that Gomer moment where you're saying, I'm not sure. It doesn't feel right. It's hard. It's different than everyone around me. Don't worry. He's not going to let you go. He will go through every back alley to find you. He will buy you back. You have nothing to fear of your failures, your weaknesses. Hang in there. You know, the enemy's going to tell you, you're too far gone. It's too late. You're on a slave rock. No one's coming for you. Deuteronomy even says that. No one's coming. No one's going to buy you. But Hosea shows us it's never too late. You are his beloved bride, and his face lights up whenever you turn towards him. Let's pray. Lord, thank you. Thank you that in the midst of your anger, you place words of hope and redemption. You threaded through this unbelievable book, the story of your love. We hear the anguish. And Lord, we still are baffled. Why does it matter? Why do we matter so much to you? Why do you care so deeply that you feel so deeply when we turn from you? Lord, I pray that each one of us truly would feel this love, would feel this unbelievable just desire you have for us, that you will go anywhere to win us back, to find us, to rescue us, to bring us home to a safe place where we can dwell with you and heal. And we thank you for this in your precious Son's name. Amen.